On today's edition of the Locked On Nets podcast, Marcus and Josh are back to talk about the Caris LeVert extension and why we think it's a great deal for the Nets, and then get you started on our series recapping the best and worst moments of the 2018-19 Nets season coming up.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome in to an edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. I am your tried and true host, Josh Bass, a lifelong fan of your Brooklyn Nets. And joining me as always, my partner in crime, Marcus Barahal. Marcus, what's going on?
Josh, what's going on? Getting excited for our big trip coming up that I'm sure all the listeners know about and care about.
I know. They're all very excited for us, I'm sure. We need to figure out what we're doing on the trip in terms of content. Are we going to be doing a lot of shows from the car?
I would like to do at least one from the car. I think that would be cool. An on the road pod.
Okay. Yeah, we could do like a mailbag. This is going to be great. We've locked on Knicks host Gavin Shaw, so we can get some competitive intelligence and maybe sabotage them. That could be good.
I don't know if intelligence is the right word for Gavin, but we'll get some content.
Very, very true. Great ether on your part.
Thank you.
So we are going to get into our series on the best moments and worst moments of the previous season. But first, just want to talk about some Nets news, and also want to say that I joined Josh Lloyd on Locked On Fantasy, our boy, the best Australian Josh. I am the best American Josh. But join Josh Lloyd on his Locked On Fantasy podcast to talk about all the Brooklyn Nets and their fantasy prospects for this upcoming season. Marcus, you and I are both avid fantasy players, so please check that out on Josh's show. It should get posted over the weekend. But Marcus, Caris LeVert signed an extension that I don't think anyone was expecting, especially still in the summer, a couple months before the deadline. 3 years, $52.5 million. On first blush, I really like this for the Nets. Is that what you're thinking as well?
Yeah, definitely. It reminded me a lot of the Dinwiddie extension, where it was like, I didn't think that this was going to happen right now, but it has, and I'm very happy, especially with the number.
Definitely, definitely. And I think, like, obviously, any contract signed before someone hits free agency should be a bit more team-friendly, because the players is mitigating the risk that they go out, get hurt, and then just get a contract offer that's nowhere near what they had been expecting a few months before. And obviously, LeVert's case, he just suffered a major, major injury this past year. Pretty lucky that it wasn't even worse, considering he didn't even need to have surgery. And no one expected, as soon as it happened against the Timberwolves, that he was going to play again this year. But he had an up-and-down season last year. He started off gangbusters those first dozen games or so, really emerging as the Nets' best player. Obviously, had such a gruesome injury. In the meantime, D'Angelo Russell stepped up. Obviously, Spencer Dinwiddie was someone that was pretty entrenched in the Nets rotation from the season before. And then when LeVert came back, kind of struggled to find his footing a bit, but he really excelled during the playoffs.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that you said it was up and down, which I do agree with. And I think that a lot of that was because of the injury. Like, he was great, like you said, when he started, got hurt, came back, and we both saw it took him a few games to get back into it, but I think that made him coming back when he did, like a little bit before the playoffs, even more important. Because then once the playoffs got rolling, and like even that little stretch before where the Nets kind of heated up to secure that playoff spot, because there was like a brief stretch where it was like, are they going to make it? Are they going to end up choking this away? But he played really well in those last few games. And then in the playoffs, obviously, he was like the Nets' best player. So, I think it was an up and down season. I think that he clearly has like a lot of room to improve and grow, especially if he can stay healthy. And this contract kind of has the potential, at least, to be, not to say that he's going to end up being this type of player, but like what the Warriors had with the Steph Curry contract when he signed that extension after having those ankle injuries, where it was like clear that he was like a very good player. If he could stay healthy, there was like a lot of potential. And I think that's similar with LeVert, where if he stays healthy and he keeps going on this trajectory, like this contract's going to be a bargain. Just looking at guys who made like 17, 18 million last season, because that's what LeVert's going to make on this contract. It's guys like Evan Fournier, Derek Favors, Bismack Biyombo.
Derek Favors in the same category. He's good.
That's fine. I've never been a big Derek Favors guy. Shout out to David Locke. But regardless, LeVert could definitely like outperform this contract, assuming he stays healthy and keeps going on this path. So for the Nets, it's a good value. And for LeVert, if he does get hurt, obviously it's good that he secured some money. And the fact that I think both he and Dinwiddie signed these contracts that were probably less than they could have gotten on the open market speaks again to that Nets culture and like wanting to stay with this team.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think for LeVert, it makes sense as well because obviously he's found a good thing with the Nets, but for him, there's still a lot of uncertainty in how his career pans out. He's someone that's shown a lot of promise. He has a wide variety of skills, but what does he truly do at an elite level? He's very injury prone, both in the NBA and also in college. So it makes sense for him just to lock down that enormous life-changing sum of money, over $50 million. Because especially, you know, with this year coming up, I think he's going to be good because you have Kyrie Irving playing the D'Angelo Russell role, but just a more efficient scorer, not as good of a pure passer. Maybe that will give LeVert some more playmaking opportunities. But let's say he has this extension in next year and the year after that when Kevin Durant's healthy and firing on all cylinders, hopefully. I'm not sure how LeVert's role is going to really fit in because you have Kyrie and KD who are kind of the two ball dominant guys, elite scorers, and LeVert would probably have to play a role where it's more so off the ball and shooting, and that's really been his one weakness. So I think for the Nets, even if things don't pan out in terms of fit 2 years down the line, you still have LeVert on a very tradable contract and can send him off to a team where he might fit better and be one of the one or two more primary creators, which uses his skill sets a bit better because obviously his shot is just not improved at all in the three seasons in the NBA. His touch is great, but as I say time and time again, he completely rushes his form and he has no consistency on it.
Yeah, and I think just fitting in with those other guys, his role could be on like perimeter defense, especially with like Kyrie Irving's. He's not like the best defender. He can be okay at times, but I think LeVert's length and like ability to guard kind of 1-3, depending on who's out there. I think that could be a role for him. In addition to obviously like the secondary or even like tertiary once Durant's back, playmaking and shot creation, things like that. So I think that there would be a role for him, but like you said, his contract and Dinwiddie's are both extremely movable. Not that we're advocating that. I think we're both big fans of both of those guys.
Yeah, obviously they have to give it a shot, make sure the fit works. But I'm saying backup plan.
Yeah,
if they need it to ship them elsewhere. I think they could definitely do that. And I think the point about LeVert being a versatile defender is a really good one, especially guarding point guards. He's going to be someone that's really valuable because Kyrie, obviously not the reputation as the best defender. Dinwiddie has the tools, but last year his effort was just horrible in the regular season. I think D'Angelo Russell was probably a pound for pound better defender than him in the regular season. Dinwiddie did turn it on a bit in the playoffs. So really in terms of guys that can credibly defend point guards, you have LeVert and David Nwaba. And obviously, LeVert's a much better offensive player than Nwaba. No shots to David. So, Caris LeVert secured the bag, and so can you with DoorDash. Had a long day at work, still stuck at the office. Open the DoorDash app, choose what you want to eat, and your food will be delivered to you wherever you are. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order of 15 or more when you download the DoorDash app and enter promo code locked on. Okay, Marcus, we talked a little bit about the LeVert news, but now we have to get to our long-awaited, or at least you and I are awaiting it, recap of the 2018-19 season in terms of the best and worst moments. We teased you guys a bit last episode, giving some of our honorable mentions, but it's time to get into the real thing. It's finally here. Marcus, kick us off with your fifth best moment of last season.
My fifth best moment. Okay. That I'm going to take you back, Josh, put you in a time machine here.
Ooh.
We're going to go back right around the All-Star game. I believe it was just before. It was the Cavs triple OT game. Marquese Chris was banging threes. The Nets somehow managed to hold on and win a game that probably, I don't know, like when I was watching this game in real time, I was thinking like, this is not going to be like one of my favorite moments because I'm staying up way too late and this game is going on way too long. But in hindsight, it was like just a testament to the team's perseverance to kind of battle through all three overtimes. D'Angelo Russell got like red hot in the third one and was just kind of like, all right, enough's enough. Like, I'm in the All-Star game. I need to get going and pack my bag and get on a flight. But I was just super entertained during this game for the most part. I think just seeing like those random characters on the Cavs, Jordan Clarkson had 42 points in that game. It was just kind of absurd. And it was just one that kept me enthralled throughout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was definitely something that I considered, ended up outside my top five honorable mentions at ninth on my list. But this was a very entertaining game. I remember exactly where I was. I was sitting in a hotel room in Sarasota. I'd just gotten in, bleary-eyed, but I remember I was just screaming at my computer as Jordan Clarkson and Marquese Chris were doing a lot of damage. And Marcus, if you remember, the Nets had kind of been red hot before, not red hot before this, because they had lost five of their last six, but this came after a really nice nice winning streaks. They had had really good wins against teams like Houston. They had beaten, who else did they beat in that stretch? I think the Nuggets. They had one of their nice wins over the Nuggets. So I was expecting to say, hey, it's right before the All-Star break. They'll come in, get a win, finish the first half at 30-29, and really did not expect it to be as much of a struggle. But in terms of just like, in terms of quality of play, I don't think this is necessarily up there. But in terms of memorable games, this is one that I had my eye on as well.
Yeah, and there were so many to choose from. Part of it was just that I didn't want to overlap with you too much. Felt like you wouldn't pick this, Josh. I know you're not a
you're right.
You're not a stay up late guy, you know.
I can be. Yeah. I'm an early riser though.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't give the listeners don't make me look bad in front of the listeners.
All right, I won't disparage you.
Thank you. My number five moment. This was something that when I started my list, I thought I was going to actually have it higher, top two or three maybe. But it's the insane comeback win against Houston in January, overtime game, 145-142. This was the game. D'Angelo Russell ended up getting benched in this game, even though he didn't play that terribly. But this was really the insane performance by Spencer Dinwiddie. Remember, the Nets were down like 9 with a minute and a half. They were still down 6 with under a minute left. And he just kept going in, pulling up for these insane threes and hitting them. But Houston was scoring on the other end. But there were a lot of trading threes for twos. Remember, P.J. Tucker in regulation. Harden misses a free throw in regulation. P.J. Tucker gets the offensive rebound but misses both free throws. This was just, I think it was something like that, but this was just an insane game. Dinwiddie pulling up, hits an amazing three to tie it in regulation. In overtime, he takes over. Jarrett Allen has a huge and one. And this was a great game. Austin Rivers had an opportunity to end in regulation with an open three. He misses it. One of his first games, a Rocket. This was just an absolute thriller.
Yeah, this was on my list as well. And shout out to Marquese Chris, second straight game that he was involved in, that we've mentioned, but yeah, I remember this game. I was out, I think, with people who were in town that night. So I think you did a solo pod after this game, and yep. I watched it the next day. But yeah, just like receiving your texts and like catching up on the game after the fact. You mentioned Jared Allen. Low-key had a 20-point, 24-rebound game in this one. And yeah, like you said, I think both of these two games so far have just shown that the Nets can kind of like, or at least the last season's version, hopefully that continues this year, they can kind of take that big punch and just keep going. Like James Harden had 58 points. And
that's insane.
And the Nets won.
Yeah. So. This is the game of role players. Travion Graham had his highlight as a Net and scoring 21 points, 7 of 9 from the field. It was hitting threes. I was all in on Travion Graham after this. I'd have to go back and look and listen to the other pod because I'm sure I was just singing his praises. James Nunnally was doing a lot of damage for Houston. Hitting some threes. I remember I was so pissed about that. But yeah, this was just one of my favorite games of the season because just to see Dinwiddie's highlights in overtime in the last 3 minutes of regulation where he probably put up 20 points or so was just a thriller to watch and why he's one of my favorite players.
Definitely. My next moment, my number four good moment, is actually not a game. It's Joe Harris winning the three-point contest. This, for me, I felt like I had to put this in because Now that Joe Harris is like officially on the FIBA roster for Team USA, he's like fully arrived. And I thought that this was like a really cool moment where with him in this contest, with Dinwiddie winning the skills challenge the year before, with D'Lo making the All-Star team this year, it was like a nice culmination of everything that the Nets have kind of worked towards and built towards and getting that national recognition. And they've got more national TV games this year, so hopefully that keeps going for other role guys. But to see Joe Harris like out there with the Curry brothers, with Devin Booker, with Dirk, with Kemba Walker, like all these guys, and he was incredibly clutch. He hit all of his money balls at the end to seal the win, beating Steph by two. And so just seeing that, seeing everyone on Twitter like immediately after the fact, from like Jared Dudley being like, "I told you guys," to just like random NBA players that I follow who are like bigger names, who are like, "Oh, Joe Harris, like we know he can shoot, blah, blah, blah." Just seeing him get that respect around the league, I think was really cool.
Absolutely. No, I love that moment as well. And I love the Joe Harris media tour that immediately ensued after that, with him going on Howard Beck's show. I think he went on the Low Post as well, with along with Sarah Kustak. That was great to see. And I love how just like he was clearly hype, but he's just not someone that shows a lot of emotion. So he was just kind of no selling it, which was great. But obviously a big moment for the Nets. I mean, if we did this list last year, my number one moment of the 17-18 season probably would have been Spencer Dinwiddie winning the skills challenge, because I remember watching that with some friends, and it was me and one other Nets fan that were in the room, and we were actually just so hype. That really was the highlight of the season. I think either it was Shaq or Kenny Smith made fun of the Nets saying, or maybe it was Chuck saying, actually it was the highlight of the Nets year. So the trend continues with a Net winning an event at All-Star Weekend. Does that mean someone's going to win the dunk contest?
Yeah, I guess it would probably be Jared Allen. I don't know who else would even like enter.
I don't know who else in this can dunk. Kurtz?
Yeah,
I guess. Yeah, he's definitely up there. That was a great moment, though. On to my number four, and it's a moment that's very dear to my heart. It's game one of the first round playoffs against the Philadelphia 76ers. We were riding on cloud nine, Marcus. The Nets came out drilling threes. Damari Carroll was killing it, his only really good game of the playoffs. LeVert was dominant, and this was something where it wasn't even close. The Nets just came out, destroyed Philly in Philadelphia, swung home court for the series back in their favor. I was ready to trash talk Keith Pompey on Twitter, but it was just such a great win. It was euphoric for the Nets. Unfortunately, the rest of the series panned out basically the complete opposite, but we'll always have game one.
Yeah, that's on my list as well. Just seeing your dad and you get like so happy. We were watching with them and with Gavin, and Gavin kept trying to, I think, either like jinx it or reverse jinx it. He was like, "Oh, Philly's gonna come back, blah blah blah." But and Jimmy Butler played phenomenally for Philly and like was the only reason that they were even somewhat in the game. But yeah, like you said, the Nets came out red hot to start, and that was kind of the only game in that series where they did that, where they kind of put Philly down. And we talked about the rest of the series how Philly's a team that like doesn't really like to play from behind, and so the Nets getting that early head start kind of I think like punched Philly in the face, and they just weren't ready for it. And yeah, it was the only game where kind of all three of the guards showed up in different ways. D'Lo didn't have his best game of the year or anything like that, but he at least put up 26 points, albeit on 25 shots. But LeVert was great. Dinwiddie was great. Ed Davis, who one of the like low-key turning points of the series was him turning that ankle. But he played really well. A literal turning point when he turned his ankle. But yeah, Joe Harris was great. Like everyone played well, and it was just like an incredibly balanced effort. I remember Philly, like the fans were like booing. It was just like it was a real joy to see.
Yeah, it was a lot of Theo Pinson dancing. Yeah, that does remind me of the Ed Davis thing. That really sucked.
Yeah, it was, and I feel like it like didn't really get talked about enough. I think because everyone was focusing on Embiid's health and like him playing or not playing, but Ed Davis was like a huge loss.
Yeah, he was a huge loss in the series, and I think he's going to be a huge loss this year. Not to say that DeAndre can't necessarily replicate his production, but I don't know. I'm going to miss Ed Davis.
Me too. Yeah. Maybe Nick Claxton steps up.
We can only hope. We're going to take a quick break, and then coming up, we will give you some of our other top moments of the Nets season coming up. It's Crossover Wednesday. The NFL season begins next week, which means Crossover Wednesday will be back for the entire regular NFL season. You will get a special episode every Wednesday as the hosts from opposing sides meet up to preview the excitement of the games happening that week. Find your favorite team wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure not to miss the NFL listeners' favorite segment for Marcus and I. That will both be Locked On Jets. Marcus, are you excited for the Jets season?
Yeah, I am. I'm always excited at the start of football season. You know, it's so short that I feel like anything can happen. Maybe Sam Darnold takes off this year. Maybe Robbie Anderson stays on the field. Could be a great year.
We can only hope. And our boy, John Buchko, will be covering it all day on Locked On Jets. Laj, L-O-J. Hi, Marcus. We've had some good. Let's sprinkle in a little bit of our worst moments, unfortunately. Starting with your third worst moment of the season, what was that?
This was actually right before I took over from Gavin on the podcast. It was the loss to the Thunder in December. This like sunk the Nets down to 8-18, a number or two numbers, I guess, that would be like referenced a lot once they eventually came back as like this was the low point of the season. We were 8-18. We came all the way back. This was a game where the Nets were leading most of the way, looked like it could be a best moment of the year candidate at the time. And then OKC plus 20 in the fourth quarter to end up winning by two, all capped off with that Paul George three with like 3 seconds left to put OKC up two and give them the win. He was incredible in this game. He had 47 points and 15 rebounds, similar to that Harden effort. But in this game, there was also Russell Westbrook, who had 21, 17, and 15, which is also insane. James Harden did not have that. So a little bit too much for the Nets, especially late. And this just was, like I said, one of the lowest points of the season where you're kind of, I was at least wondering, like, should the Nets just pack it in at this point? 10 games under 500, less than 30 games into the season. So they obviously didn't do that, turned it around. But this was definitely a low point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was something I remember. I think I was out and I was following the game on my phone, and the Nets were just destroying the Thunder, especially after three quarters when they're up like 20 points. I'm like, ah, whatever. This is fine. I don't have to seriously pay attention anymore. I can watch the game when I get back or the next morning. But then all of a sudden, I just see an alert on my phone saying, okay, like close game alert. I'm like, this isn't supposed to happen. Obviously. When I watched the tape back, Paul George, as you mentioned, just went crazy. This is a game where Allen Crabbe hit seven threes, and those didn't happen very often for the Nets. So you can't waste that. And this was, again, one of the nadirs of the season, as you mentioned, capping off an eight-game losing streak for the Nets. And they really turned their season around after this. But I think the general sentiment around the team following this game was that they just weren't going to be able to close out games. And it was something that had been a trend for the previous 2 years as well. They just didn't have any top players on their team that could get these close wins. Of course, we were proven wrong, but this was definitely a sign that there could have been, the season could have definitely gone really downhill, and a great job by Kenny and the team to ensure that morale was kept up and that they fought hard to really work their way back in the playoff race and ultimately get into the big dance.
Yeah, and right after this game, they wound up winning seven straight games and 9 of 10. So again, showing the resilience of the team. They won that next game against Toronto in overtime, which was very special. A candidate, I will say, for my favorite game. That was my first game doing a podcast with you, Josh.
Yeah, that was great. You were the immediate good luck charm. I mean, listen, but the Nets went 34 and 22 in the Marcus era.
Yeah.
And we have probably had a terrible winning percentage in the Gavin era.
Yeah, I was the Joe Tsai to Gavin's Prokhorov.
Yes, you were the Joe Tsai. I'm going to tell Gavin that. I'm going to start calling him Prokhorov.
Oh, my God.
My third worst moment is a similar type of game, another heartbreaker against a very good team. It was the loss to Philly, one of Jimmy Butler's first games. Marcus, I don't know if you remember this one, but I do very vividly. The Nets had come out. They'd played Philly a few times last year, obviously had the blowout win at the start, had another really close win. But this game was something where they had a huge lead. This was, I believe, Thanksgiving weekend, that Sunday maybe. The Nets were up, I think, 12 or so at halftime, were up 15 or so for most of the game. And then Jimmy Butler just caught fire, was unstoppable late. Him and Embiid hit that insane buzzer beater at the end. This was not the first time Jimmy Butler had a buzzer beater over the Nets. He had one when he was a member of the Bulls, just kind of cradling the ball, and then just taking a step back over Bogdanovich that time and draining it. So Jimmy Butler is quietly a Nets killer. That was one of his first games with Philly, really coming out and asserting himself, showing why they brought him here, so to speak, and wasting an epic performance from D'Angelo Russell and Spencer Dinwiddie. Those guys combined for basically 70 points in this one. D'Lo was 38 points, 8 rebounds, 8 assists. He was awesome. Dinwiddie, who had an amazing year against Philly in the regular season, not so much in the playoffs, went off for 31 points on 11 of 15 shooting. And when those two guys were cooking like they did, you want to hope the Nets to get a win. This was earlier on in that losing streak. That was ended up being capped off by the loss to the Thunder. But this was one of the more depressing ones out there.
Yeah, I pulled up the box score from this game. It's kind of crazy to see some of the numbers, like Rondé playing 30 minutes, Alan Crabb playing 25 minutes, Kuroks like not even on the roster here. And also there's like a post game interview with Jimmy Butler after the game, and he's saying, "I can see this being home," about Philly. So that didn't work out. But
six-month home.
Yeah, it was a temporary homestay. Like you said, Jimmy Butler has been like a Nets killer for a while. I mentioned him even in that one game that the Nets won in that playoff series. He was kind of the only guy doing stuff. And then once Embiid went down, Simmons obviously like turned it around too, but Jimmy Butler was one of the main catalysts for Philly in that series. So I remember when he actually got ejected in that game with Jared Dudley, I was like, oh, like this actually, it obviously hurts the Nets because of the Dudley loss, but Jimmy Butler was playing like so well in that series. I thought maybe that could be something.
Yeah, no, it ended up that Jared Dudley was more important to the Nets than Jimmy Butler was to the Sixers, unfortunately.
Yeah, and both are on different teams this year, so we'll see how that plays out.
Exactly. Okay, that is we gave you guys the first half of our best and worst moments of the season. We hope it gets you. We hope it not even gets you excited, just elicits some emotion for next season, whether that's grief, pure anger, euphoria, excitement.
Great show.
All the emotions that we want you to hear and really invoke when we're talking about these moments from last season, the highs and the lows. We will come back later this week to give you part two and wrap that up. But in the meantime, you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast feed, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Himalaya. Please follow us on Twitter. The podcast is at Locked On Nets. Marcus is at Marcus Barahal. I am at JMBass_. And until next time, be well.
Bye.